B-Pod Studios.
They're Boston's number one afternoon show.
The most powerful sports radio show in New England.
America's number one afternoon sports show.
Yeah, but we're the biggest.
And number one in your heart.
And I just came here to help your ratings.
Sorry, John. Thank you. Don't need it.
Felger and Mass, 98.5, the Sports Hub.
I will say this, Scott. Jaylen Brown also sassed them, okay, if you guys leave here, are you just going to leave and go chill and hang out with your families and lose that loneliness, or are you going to be in the trenches? Are you going to be in the streets? And so to me, if you leaving just to leave and be mad, that's a waste of time. If you're going to do what Jaylen Brown said, be in the streets, be active. But to leave just because, like, if you're going to be about it, be about it. And let's see if they leave, they got to be about it, because they're certainly going to lose a lot about it.
Again, Mark Spears, they're a little tangled up there at the end, but his point's the same. And, you know, all for protesting and demonstrating peacefully and all of that. But the leverage is now. They have the leverage now because money's at stake. And that's how you get people to move, and that's unfortunately how it works. And so they can go and leave and protest all they want, but then they will have lost sort of the ability to, again, what I would be doing is getting people on the horn and, you know, trying to speed up the process of what's ever going on there in Kenosha and start with that. And maybe they can affect that. But once they leave, I think they sort of lose that power, Maz.
Well, yeah, because, so look, again, I understand that part of it. But what Jaylen Brown is also saying there, Mike, is the opposite. If you want to leave and get out there in the trenches, then let's get out there and get in the trenches. You know, I think he's saying if we're going to be sincere about it, let's be sincere about it. He's just, I feel like Brown's preaching against the phoniness of, let's walk, because really what guys want to do is go home. I mean, if that's the case, then they shouldn't walk. But to me, if I'm an NBA player and I'm deeply affected, I'd have walked. I'd have walked. Then you'd really have everybody's attention.
I think the threat to walk is more impactful. The threat to walk is, because once you've walked, they've already lost their money, and now what do you have as leverage? You're already gone. You already blew up the sport. So we've already lost our money. So, you know, why are we going to listen to you? They really have them now. All that money's on the table to finish this for the sponsors, for the league, you know, for everybody, for fans, for us. You know, the return worked. They've worked. Both these sports are back, and they're pulling it off, and they've brought us back in. And the ratings are good. They're, you know, really good in some cases. And it's like it's working. And if the threat to take that away, I think, gets people to move. Once they take it away, it's already gone.
Yeah, well, they've now just proven, like, look, you know, we need to see some action here from you guys, because otherwise we will leave. We've just proven it to you. We'll go. It doesn't matter that much.
I would say the ambiguous sort of we need change is, that's a big, what are you going to, you're not going to change it overnight.
Right.
And you're not, like, that's got to be a generational sort of macro thing that you're looking for. That's not going to happen. But you can get the wheels of justice to spin faster. You can, as I mentioned before, you can get people on the horn in Kenosha. And you can make sure that all the details of everything comes to light and the proper people are held accountable and they're done swiftly. Whereas if you weren't doing it, maybe the sheriffs in Kenosha would take their sweet time, because that's just the culture there. And you can affect that. And so I'm all for that. I'm all for that. Let's take a few more phones on this until you get so annoying that we have to stop taking them. George in Halifax. Go ahead, George.
Hey, Felger and Mass. I just got two quick questions. What are your thoughts on Kenny walking out of the TNT show? And it's going to ruin the chemistry between Shaq, Charles, and Kenny.
So why should it ruin it?
I don't know. Just because they just didn't walk with him, I think it should have been, you know, the three basketball players. If they were going to do it, he showed up on the show and they just decided to walk. So
I haven't read up on did Kenny tell him he was going to do that, or was
no,
it sort of a surprise?
I think it was pretty much a surprise. And if you watch it, I think it's pretty obvious, because Charles Barkley takes such an uncomfortable sip from his cup, like, holy crap, what just happened, as Kenny Smith walked off. And, you know, I respect that, too. If Kenny Smith, you know, obviously feels that strongly about it and wanted to support the players that walked out, like, I'm all for it. And I don't see why there'd be any discourse. Those guys all seem like they have a good rapport. I would like to think that they're pretty friendly in real life. So if they respect each other's decisions, why? I'd like to think that Kenny Smith isn't mad that the rest of the set didn't walk off.
Well, and I would say to the caller, too, why does it have to be all three? See, this is sort of the
right,
same.
Right, it's the all or nothing thing that drives
me
crazy.
Right, this is what I'm talking about. It's like, why can't it just be, hey, this, you know, Kenny Smith is bothered by this, so he's walking off, and Shaq and Barkley say, no, Sweat, we'll do it without you. We're good. We can do a two-man show tonight. Or, you know, two analysts. We can do it with two guys. No problem. See you later. If you feel good, if you feel strongly about it, you go ahead. We're going to stay, and you do what you need to do. Like, why is that so hard? Why
peaceful
is that so
protest,
impossible?
Peaceful protest for a worthy cause. And then we'll get back to ripping each other about basketball, you know, when the time comes. All good. Like, shouldn't be a problem. Why would it be? That's an excellent point by you guys. What do we got here? How about Cliff in Boston? He's up next with Felger Mass. Hi, Cliff.
How you doing, guys? I just don't – the thing that I don't understand is it's automatically a racist thing when that's not proven yet. Nobody knows all the facts, and then you have Jaylen Brown coming out and saying it's X, Y, and Z, and everybody has to do it, or you're a racist, or you're looked upon badly, when nobody knows. It obviously wasn't a racist-motivated thing.
You don't know
the
that.
Yeah, you don't know that.
Listen.
You don't know that.
You don't know that.
You just got through with ripping Jaylen Brown for saying, for making a conclusion, for not knowing, and then you did the exact same thing. So again, why don't you just say what you are, which is on the other side of the political aisle, and it riles you up? Because you just did the exact same thing that you're ripping Jaylen Brown for, except on the other side. We have no idea if the cop had racial intentions or racial motivations. None. I think it's entirely possible race had nothing to do with it. If Big Jim Murray with his tats and his menacing 6'4" frame gets tased, gets up, wrestles with the cops, and then reaches in the car for something, you might get shot, Jim. Black, white, green, or red with purple polka dots, right? Like,
no doubt about that.
You know, it's entirely possible it wasn't racially motivated. But it's also possible it was. We don't know the cop's background. We don't know what else is on his record. We don't know how he's handled other incidents before. We don't know what was said earlier in the confrontation. We don't know on either side. We don't know on either side.
I also think, Mike, I also get tired of the you know, well, this incident was, or what? It's not about this incident per se. Okay, I get it. And I don't know what this incident was either. But the point is, there's a much bigger issue there that clearly is very raw, and there's an extremely exposed nerve there. So anytime anything even remotely resembling police brutality or a racial injustice takes place, people react to it. So again, it might not be the case in this incident. Does that mean the problem doesn't exist?
Yeah, it doesn't mean that it wasn't wildly aggressive, and that's putting it mildly, that they shot the guy in the back 7 times, put one in his thigh, put one in his, like, it's beyond excessive, considering what was happening at that time, based on the video that we've all seen.
And then people demonstrate, protest, and they allow the militias in. They allow the militiamen, the kids with the assault rifles over their shoulder, and hand them water bottles and say, thanks for being here. Oh, please, come on. Like, that's a piece that's unambiguous to me. There's no arguing that one, I don't think. I don't know how you, I don't know how you support that. Like, that's what it's come to? That's what we're accepting. And that's what's okay. I mean, come on. And, oh, by the way, that's when the boycott started, after the Monday-Tuesday nonsense in Kenosha. Never mind the original thing, which, you know, is scary, you know, is scary in its own right. John in Rockland. Go ahead, John. Case got us on hold. How about Alex in Vermont? You're up next with Felger and Mass. Hi, Alex.
Hey, guys. Thanks for taking my call, and thanks for hanging up on the guy who's defending wannabe Batman from Illinois. I just want to say that I agree with Felger and disagree with Matt. I think that players in all sports leagues will continue to have a bigger voice with these issues if they continue to play. I think once they play their hand and go home and stop playing, they become less of public figures. So I just want to get your guys' thoughts on that.
Yeah, well, I mean, they lose the financial leverage is just my only point.
Well, look, I felt that way at the beginning about the public aspect of it. I thought, no, go down and play in the bubble. The platform you get from the bubble is greater than one that you would have without basketball. Basketball is their platform. It's their vehicle. It's their absolute best way to get out the message. But I also think that, and this is my mistake, that once the bubble started and the playoffs started, and they, you know, they put the slogan on the floor, Black Lives Matter, and they put various, what's the right word, expressions or words or phrases on their jerseys and chose the messages they wanted to send out, that it kind of, we started focusing on the basketball again. And so I think it, you know, their cause did fade to the background a little bit, and it was reignited by the incident in Kenosha. So, you know, if guys were deeply affected, well, that was an effective threat. Deeply affected, that was an effective threat. And I think walking would have really delivered a message and would have angered many people who didn't want them to leave. And I'm not talking about owners, and I'm not talking about political influence. I'm talking about society and the public, and people would have been angered by it, and that was the point. That would to take something away from people. I think that was the point.
How do you feel about a breather from this? You want to rip the Bruins or you want to rip the Patriots? We haven't ripped the Patriots yet today.
We can rip the Patriots for a little while. I'm good with that.
Okay, let's rip the Patriots next as a little breather from this nonsense. Don't go anywhere.
Boston's home for sports. Fill your mess. 98.5 The Sports Hub.
BackstageCountry.com, your online home for all things country music. It's going to be a busy year for country superstar Jason Aldean. He's extended his Highway Desperado tour and is teaming up with Kid Rock for Rock the Country tour dates. We've ranked our top five Jason Aldean music videos. Text Jason to 45911 to see if your favorite made the list on BackstageCountry.com. Text Jason to 45911 and we'll send the link straight to your phone.
Doing what they do best.
Now talk about soap opera.
Wilder and Mass on 98.5, The Sports Hub.
Hey, Cam, I was talking to Josh McDaniels, Coach McDaniels, the other day, and he just said that he's actually picked your brain on ways to put things in the offense to fit your skill set. So I was just wondering what that creative process has been like with Coach McDaniels and Coach Fish to, you know, use what you're good at.
Right. I mean, it's been therapeutic for me. And just knowing that these guys have been as patient throughout this process, you know, that I would have wanted them to be, you know, obviously learning a 20-year installment of plays all in a short time span is been challenging. But yet, I think it would have been more challenging if you didn't have the tutelage of a Jed, a tutelage of a Coach Josh and Jed, and, you know, even the help of other quarterbacks. Lewerke's helped me. Stiddy has helped me. Hoister has helped me. You know, receivers have helped me. And it's just been going vice, you know, back and forth. And, you know, obviously there's been some things that, you know, hasn't been implemented before, you know, and with me at the quarterback position. In times, you know, there is a dissertation, so to speak, of this is how we're expecting it to be. Okay, now can they flip it and say, well, how are you expecting it to be? And I'll say the same thing, you know, when we're in quarterback meetings. And, you know, obviously with this being my first year in this offense, as well as, you know, Coach Fish, you know, those things, you know, is something that we always ask, you know, Stiddy and Hoister and see what it's been like, you know, for them in those reads. So, you know, it's just a reciprocated attitude, you know, from learning. It just isn't a one-way street. You know, we all learn from each other, and I think that's the thing that puts me at ease.
Let's take a little breather from the boycott stuff, discuss the Patriots. We're not there to see. There's no preseason games for us to assess, so we have to go based on the reporting. Sort of old school, man. It's like people used to listen to a baseball game on the radio or just read the sports page and learn to, whatever, get on Ted Williams without ever actually having said, just, you know, he had a back and forth, right? He had a love-hate with the fans. But, you know, never saw him on TV. You just listened on the radio or, you know, read sports writers to realize that he was sucking or something. And it's sort of like this now with the Patriots offense. I sort of like it.
Oh, you got to take people's word for it.
Well, and you can even make up more stuff if you want. Like, I mean, none of us have seen it. So it's sort of like there's more editorial license. You know, Felger and Maz is not exactly fiction. It's not exactly nonfiction. I've said that Felger and Maz is based on a true story, right? So it's dramatized, you know, it's fake nonfiction. It's dramatized nonfiction.
Inspired by real events.
Exactly, right? And so that's what Felger and Maz is. So without actually seeing the Patriots, we can, it really gives us more license, which I sort of like.
Totally.
Because no one has seen what happened to dispute my takes. So it's sort of like, there's a little bit of value in this, which is all a long way of saying that was Cam Newton yesterday on learning the Patriots on offense and vice versa. And the more I'm gleaning from the reporting is that it's not working. It has me concerned. So Tom Curran tweeted out a little bit ago, bleak ass day for the Patriots offense during extensive 11-on-11 work. Details upcoming. And he hasn't posted anything yet on NBCSportsBoston.com, so I don't have those exact details. He texted me a little something, but I don't quite get it. I'm waiting for the report. Okay? But reading from Jeff Howe and others, it was a bad day for the offense.
Yep.
And, you know, the headline on Howe's thing is a detailed look at Patriots' new offense. And the sense you're getting, because the reporters can't tell us all the details, but you read between the lines and you glean that they are really trying to tailor the offense to Cam Newton, whether it's the RPOs or the read option or, you know, movement or whatever they're doing exactly. They're tailoring it to him. And apparently it ain't working. Okay. And that I'm not necessarily blaming the new offense. Maybe it's the sucky receivers. Maybe it's, well, who knows what it is, but apparently it ain't working, Maz. Do you have a thought before I go on?
Yeah. So look, again, I'm not shocked because there have been plenty of guys who've come in here over the last 20 years and had difficulty integrating into the offense when Tom Brady was the quarterback. And so the idea now that you would have a bunch of new guys coming in basically all at the same time, and that's really what we're talking about, that I'm not surprised by this in the least bit. Secondly, purely as an aside, and to be a complete wise ass, what also alarms me is that Cam Newton is relying on Lewerke for input.
Like, right, that's okay, offensive to hear.
Seriously, you want to mention, you want to say that I'm relying on some of these other guys, Stitty and Hoister, because they've been in, you know, they've been around the team longer than Cam Newton has? Fine. Lewerke? What the hell can Lewerke offer Cam Newton?
He's just trying to play along there. He's being, you know, this is the good news. He's trying to be deferential and play the game that Belichick wants him to play. And so he's just trying to, you know.
I know.
You know, play their game. You know what I mean? Which is obviously what that all is. But there was enough in there in that comment to know that it's a two-way street. They're going back and forth, and they're trying to tailor it to him. And he sort of alluded to that as well, that that's, you know, it's an open exchange. That's, you know, my way of paraphrasing it. And I just tie that together with the reporting that you hear from the guys down there who aren't allowed to tell us exactly, but, you know, that they are doing things they haven't done in the past. They're doing things that fit Cam Newton's game. And so I'm just putting it all together and, you know, saying that they're turning on their ear what they've done to fit Cam Newton, which in the short term and in the small picture is smart. You tailor your scheme to your personnel. We've talked about this all week. But is it their comfort zone? Is it what they've – I just feel so much better about plopping a guy into their system versus changing their system. And it's one thing, Maz, and I've talked a lot about this before too. Like, Bill does it routinely on defense. He'll go 3-4 one year if he has more linebackers than defensive linemen. He'll go 4-3 the next if he's got good edge guys who can put their finger in the dirt and play that elephant position. Then that's a four-man line. Or he'll go zone if he's got defensive backs that are good at zone. He'll go man if he's got good man corners like Gilmore, and they do now. Like, he changes that all the time. Don't you think it's a little harder to do that in the passing game?
Yes, I was just going to say offense is way more intricate. Way more. Because, again, at the end of the day in football, you know,
Get ball, tackle ball.
Yeah, on defense, it just can't get too complex, especially generally speaking with the way Bill does it, which is more often than not, he's not going to make himself vulnerable to a big play, whether he's playing man or zone or 3-4 or 4-3. If he's playing man, there's going to be a free safety deep. Like, you know, you follow me? In other words, the very core principle of the defense is going to be the same, that we're going to make the offense work for it. We're going to make them work for it. We're not going to give up the big plays, and we're going to make them execute and get down the field, and then we're going to tighten up in the red zone where it gets harder and it's tough to get points. So, you know, it's not like Bill, for the most part, it's not like he ever turned them into the 85 Bears and said, go get the quarterback.
No. GTFB.
Right, of course. So I'd say the general philosophy of it has always stayed the same. But, and that has been true on offense, too, because of Brady. So now, all of a sudden, all that goes out the window. Like, so this, I just think it's really hard to maintain the same thing that they want to do on offense without Brady there anymore. I just think it's going to be borderline. Not to mention, again, Mike, how many new receivers do they have? Sanu's only been here for a half year. Olszewski barely played. Myers barely played. Same with Harry. The only guy who knows the offense is Edelman. None of the tight ends know it. I'm talking about the pass catchers now, and I'm not including running backs like James White. The whole thing is first grade. You know, the whole group is in first grade.
So in terms of, you know, language and playbook and stuff, but I the actual plays they're running, it might be new to everyone other than Newton if they're tailing it to him, because the guys, you know, if you're new, you're new. Okay, so everything's new. And if you've been here in the past, you are running something else. And the more I think of it, the less I like the changing of the scheme. I mean, I'm all for turning Cam Newton loose, quote unquote. But I don't know. I'd feel better plopping a guy into your system that you know. And I just feel like that's easier versus, you know, than turning everyone over for one guy, even at the quarterback position. I don't know. I think it's part and parcel. It's feeling to me like it's not working. And, you know, this is one of the things about this year. We're going to find out. You know, we're going to find out when the bullets start flying for real in game one. Sorry for the analogy, but poor choice of words there. But, you know, when it gets real, because there's no preseason games. And as much as I like the no preseason game, but the thing I mentioned before, we can make more stuff up. It's also going to be, you know, we don't know exactly what we're looking at here, but it doesn't look great at practice, that's for sure. There was more stuff on N'Keal Harry, too, which wasn't good. And Curran mentioned this to me as well, but Jeff Howe writes about, you know, there was an incompletion to Harry that was maddening. Harry breezed past J.C. Jackson to work himself wide open in the back of the end zone, and Newton delivered a perfect ball. But Harry's lack of awareness caused him to step out of bounds before completing the catch. Bad play from Harry, who failed to catch any of his four targets in practice. So 0-for-4 to N'Keal Harry in practice. And the one they could have had, he got lazy on the back line and put his foot over the line.
Yeah, hell of a first round draft.
It's good she get Dan Orlovsky to throw him the pass then. The two of them be out of bounds the whole time. And I know nobody knows what I'm talking about, but it was one of the worst plays I've ever seen.
He says, like, Harry also blew a gasket when the defensive back celebrated by talking trash to the offense. It's good to see Harry respond with an edge, but the defensive backs know they can get under his skin, as it's the third time this week that Harry has gotten fired up in a live drill. So, Murray, you are not encouraged or optimistic about N'Keal Harry.
No, because it always seems like it's, first of all, he missed, what, 9 games last year because of the ankle? And then, what? I mean, it seemed like the team initially, especially in the preseason when he got hurt in Detroit, it was like, okay, you know, this kid feels like he's taking his time. So they seem pissed. And he came back, he didn't really make that much of an impact. And then so far at camp this year, it feels like it's always something. He's either missing or he's out for whatever the hell reason it happens to be. Or you hear that he's 0-for-4 and lazy and infuriating and unable to make catches. This guy was a first-round draft pick and another, I know it's too easy, it's too early to call him a bust, but it's starting to feel like at least lowercase b bust. And
busty.
And considering the history of wide receivers drafted by Bill Belichick, it wouldn't be that big of a surprise if he does turn out to be a bust.
I'll tell you, the image of a wide-open receiver not scoring a touchdown because he stepped out of bounds on his own, oh boy, that's ineptitude is what that is. That's
bad,
like,
football IQ.
Seriously, that's when you look at a player and say, this guy's clueless.
No, I think Murray may have nailed it. I mean, good athlete. You know, big, strong, fast, checks all those boxes. Football IQ. Right. Does he know how to run a route? Does he know how to get open? Does he know how to read a defense? Does he know where he is on the field, et cetera?
How many of those guys were drafted? Like, oh, boy, I mean, Bethel Johnson, you know, a burner. But was he a good football player? No.
But don't you find it staggering, if that's the case, that he doesn't get the game, that Bill Belichick would draft a guy like that? How do you not know that?
I don't know. At that position, right. he loses himself. He can't figure that position out.
Good guys, value, upside. I mean, just sometimes it's okay to go with the sure thing.
So, anyway, there's your Patriots minute. What do you think about it? You want to weigh in on that? You can weigh in on anything. We'll get back to your calls after Murray's update, the latest. There's been a lot of breaking news in the world of sports today. Here is the very latest.
BackstageCountry.com, your online home for all things country music. Picking five of Carrie Underwood's best music videos was no easy task, but after some debate, we landed on five we believe rise to the top. Did Carrie's 2014 hit Something in the Water make our top five? Find out when you text Carrie to 45911 and scroll through the list on BackstageCountry.com. Text Carrie to 45911 to get your eyes on our favorite Carrie Underwood music videos.
Say it.
Well, I didn't say that. Yes, you did.
Yes, they did.
Well, you said it. You said it. I can prove that you said it. You said it.
It's Felger and Mass. 98.5, the Sports Hub.
Calls as promised. Here's Chris in the car on the Pats. Go ahead, Chris.
Guys, thanks. No, you, Maz and Murray love conspiracy theories. And as we know, they're not showing us everything at Patriot practices. You know, it's very limited. Could this just be a smoke show, guys? Like, you know, they're not showing they're really going to run. And I we don't have the weapons. And Nikhil Harry really doesn't look good. But I'm just wondering, how are we getting smoke and mirrors?
Okay. I don't think so, because the reporters aren't really reporting what they're running.
Exactly.
They're just sort of alluding to it. And so the reporters have strict restrictions on what they can report and not report. They can't report formations or unusual plays or, you know, things of that nature. So the Patriots are going to run some fake plays that they're not allowing their reporters to report on anyway, knowing, though, that they will allude to them sort of vaguely. We will then pick up on it, and then the Buffalo Bills and Miami Dolphins will hear us picking up on their allusions and inferences and then game plan against those fake inferences, and it was all a smokescreen.
Yeah.
Pretty elaborate.
Belichick's the smoke show of the day.
I was going to say, that is a smoke show right there. If you want to tell me that you do that in a preseason game, or there's open practices, you know, which you typically would have in the non-apocalypse, and scouts go to opposing practices and whatnot, and, you know, you have a preseason film. Yeah, sure, maybe that's happening. I don't think that's going on here. I think they signed a running quarterback who's used to playing a certain way, and they're trying to make him comfortable and tailor the offense to him. And I don't know if it's working.
Oh, yeah. Just remember, it's all been in their playbook. You know, it's been all been there. They just don't really use it all that much.
Guy in Boston, what do you got for us today, Guy?
Yes. First of all, you're just finding out that the Patriots receivers suck. And now you want to know Bill's comfort zone? He's in Tampa. And number three, I'd like to know, you guys are crazy. Thank you.
Okay, you're welcome.
He's cracking himself up over there.
He was. Yeah, that's all he's saying. The guy was tickling himself on the phone today.
Seriously. I think Zoe said this the other day, but if N'Keal Harry is just Aaron Dobson again, like, would anyone be surprised?
God. No.
I mean, you know what I mean? Dobson wasn't a first-round pick. Was he a second-round pick?
Yeah, second rounder, yeah.
I mean, I've now heard from multiple people that are actually down there, like Bedard, that the best wide receiver at this camp is something called Devin Ross.
Okay, you still have to explain to me who that is. I haven't bothered
Mike,
anyone. Who is that?
I don't know. I know he wasn't a first-round draft pick. That's all I do know.
I think wasn't he an undrafted free agent?
Sure.
I don't know. I'm asking who he is. I don't know who he is.
Devin Ross, no. I think he was an undrafted free agent.
Let's Google who the Patriots' top receiver is. I'm just going to Google Devin Ross.
Colorado. When the hell was he drafted?
He's 5'9".
He's 25 years old. He's 5'9". That's true.
Oh, yeah. No, he's 5'9".
He's 5'9 and 25 years old.
Yeah, yep. He's going to be like Steve Smith.
Yeah, he's a late bloomer.
Well, so wait a minute. This is their best receiver. 5'9", 192. It's thick, though. You know, fire hydrant. But 5'9", well, he's winning many jump balls. Has he never played?
First year, yeah. Rookie.
A 25-year-old rookie? What's he been doing the last 3 years?
Accounting. I have no idea.
Yeah, he was waiting for a growth spurt, Felga.
That's their leading receiver. You got to be kidding me. Lucas in Norfolk. Go ahead, Lucas.
Hey, how you guys doing? So I'm getting into the N'Keal Harry thing with you. And, you know, they picked him at the end of the first round. The end of the first round. And when did DK Metcalf go? Mid, end of second? He had 7 touchdowns, 1,000 yards, and I just think that maybe Cam Newton would like to throw to DK Metcalf a little over N'Keal Harry. Thanks, guys.
So I have to be honest. When I see DK Metcalf play, I see N'Keal Harry. I mean, aren't they similar? Big, thick, athletic guys that just sort of go up and get it?
Well, Metcalf's got some more speed, though, I think. And
does he?
And he also has a quarterback that, A, worked with him last year, and, B, can get the ball downfield.
Well, this is sort of what I'm driving at. It's like, if you would put DK Metcalf here, would we have the same frustrations we have with N'Keal Harry?
Maybe. And look, again, now we're going back to Brady, right? Because I know Harry's not having a good camp, but it's really about the last 20 years.
And well, it may also be the whole culture. I'm sorry to jump in, Maz. I mean, you know, Pete, I'm sure, is like, yeah, man, just go out there and go do it, man. Yeah. Go get it. Get pumped to Jack and go get it. And they don't care what else he does. We're here. They care about everything else that you do.
I think there's a lot of physical similarities. That's not the guy I look at, and I'm like, that's who you missed out on. No, you missed out on A.J. Brown, who went in the second round of the Tennessee
Titans. How about N'Keal Hardman? Was that the same draft?
Mecole Hardman?
Mecole Hardman, same draft, Kansas City, second round, 56th overall. Marquise Brown, Terry McLaurin, who went to the Redskins, Debo Samuel, right, and the Niners. Like, there's a lot of guys that went later that you should be like, why didn't we get him? DK Metcalf, like, I don't know. I don't miss out on him that much. Some of those other guys, like, oh, my God.
Okay, so, Mike, when you talk about the culture, I'll give you how about the offense? Like, and I'll say this till I'm blue in the face at the risk of sounding like someone who used to work here. The whole idea of, if the offense is so freaking complex that nobody can get it, what good is it? You've got to dumb it down and simplify it so that people can actually run the plays. If they can't figure it out, what good is it? You got to do it in such a manner that you can actually use your players.
Long commercial-free segment. We'll get back to ripping the Bruins. We just spent a little time ripping the Patriots. Just a diversion from the boycott talk and your insufferable political calls. Anything but that. So that means ripping the Patriots and ripping the Bruins, which, let's face it, far more worthy of our ripping. We'll get back to them in our long commercial-free segment next.
Felger and Mass on 98.5 The Sports Hub. And streaming anywhere you go on the Sports Hub app.
BackstageCountry.com, your online home for all things country music. Like most fans of country music, we're excited to learn that Luke Combs was back in the studio working on his next album. We've come up with our list of iconic Luke Combs music videos. Yes, Lovin' On You made the cut. Text Luke to 45911 to see if your favorite made the list on BackstageCountry.com. Text Luke to 45911 and we'll send the link straight to your phone.
Now carried in. Oh, the linesman with a pick out in front. It's Gordy. Fires and scores. One of the Bruins got picked by the linesman. And that allowed Gord to go right to left out in front. 2-0 Tampa. Well,
what is the linesman doing that deep in the zone? He's trying to get out of the way. He was at the blue line and the puck was coming towards him. So he went into the zone and he picked Lauzon. And Yanni Gord takes this puck right to the net from the right wing side. He's a left shot. Holds it. Gets Halak to go down, and then puts it up and over top of him. But, I mean, a couple of tough breaks right now for the Bruins. They got to reel this thing in. I mean, I know the linesman's trying to get out of the way, but that's a tough break.
All right, let's reset our Bruins slot. You knew it was over right there. I did anyway. You just had a feeling. I usually think the Bruins are going to lose, but I really felt it last night. I really felt it. I felt it early. I felt the karma, Maz. I felt, Tampa gets another early power play, right? Which is like, feels like every game, Bruins are taking a penalty in the first couple minutes. Bees kill it. And so now Tampa's like 0 for 16, 0 for the last 16 on the power play. It keeps getting brought up. It's like 0 for 16. And then Nick Ritchie, that useless stiff, takes a stupid penalty, and because it was so dumb, and it was so ticky-tack, by the way, but both, it was both things, right? He does it in front of both refs, and he's not the one to be doing it. It was also a ticky-tack call. But either way, they call that one like, you can forget about the 0 for 16. I just knew it. And sure enough, Tampa scores right away off a Chara's stick. Nothing Halak could really do about that one. Now it's 1-0, and then minutes later, the linesman tackles Lauzon, and Gord gets a clean break, and now it's 2-0, and that was the game. And that's how I felt sitting in my chair at home. And the most disgusting thing is that how the Bruins played it the rest of the way, too. Like, they thought it was over. They sort of gave the game away at that point as well.
I mean, to me, this was easily the most alarming part of the game, is that they imploded. They imploded. They completely caved in. And I don't know how you look at that and feel good about them. So it's one thing to lose a hockey game. It's another thing to just completely cave under a little bit of adversity. And again, to me, it's an easy comparison. Tampa Bay the night before had a couple of bad breaks at the beginning. The Bruins, you know, jammed a goal in that could have easily been blown dead because the puck was under the goaltender's pad, Vasilevsky's pad. Then there was an offside call that negated a Tampa goal. And so you're looking at the whole thing saying Tampa could have buckled there. What did they do? They hung in there. They fought. They won.
Yeah, it's like I said after the overtime loss in game two, I wish the Bruins had all collectively the mentality of Brad Marchand, because Brad Marchand, I think, has been by and large the best player for the Bruins in this series, and he's trying to undo the wrong of last year and the loss to the Blues. And then after that, it was, you know, and how that whole thing unfolded the way you just broke it down, like, they all just gave up except for, you know, Marchand still was fighting till the end. And that drives me crazy. Like, can you just at least, I don't know, collectively give a little bit more? Like, he is, like, that's driving me crazy. But I don't know. I hated how Cassidy went into this game. The lineup changes. Nick Ritchie, one of the 11 forwards, that guy blows. I don't really get what he does. He doesn't intimidate anyone. He didn't hit well. That stupid penalty was the last straw for me. Bjork for Stadnika, I'd be okay with if you put those guys in, but Moore, Lozon, like, I don't know, see how that made sense. And Halak, he is what he is. I don't know. Like, if you want to be mad, again, I think the guy to be mad at is the guy that's on his couch in Newton. Not Halak, he is what he is.
Yeah, Mike, they caved to the point where Tampa felt, and again, I focus on this at the end of the game because I thought, you know, to me it was symptomatic of how the thing has tilted from one team to the other. Coleman punched Krejci right in the face. And it was a jab. Okay, I'm exaggerating. And I know it was a scrum. He grabbed onto his jersey, but he popped him right in the face. And so it reached the point where the Bruins were so soft in so many ways. I mean that mentally as much as anything.
Oh, the Krug thing where he's shooting the puck at the ref at the end of the game.
How about that one?
Oh, I hated that.
Tell me that wasn't Mickey Mouse petty bullcrap. What, you're pissed off because you're getting your ass kicked, so you snap the puck over at the referee? Get out of here. That was one of the two misconducts they got in the third period. I don't know how many people know that, because, again, they checked out. McAvoy got a misconduct. At least his was in retaliation trying to protect somebody. But Krug snapped the puck over at the referee. Get out of here. You're gone, too. See you later. Oh, they completely imploded. They caved in.
So, a lot of, you know, little things to get to. I mean, when I say little things, sort of just notes from last night. That effing lineup, I hated it, too. I didn't even realize John Moore was anywhere close to being back on the ice. I don't know why he needed to be back on the ice. I hated the fact that between the lineup and the way the minutes were doled out and the way the approach was in that game, it felt like kind of a scheduled loss, or just one that they knew they'd sort of be in trouble with anyway, so they wanted to preserve guys for later in the series, which frustrates me because the Bruins took the round robin off, and I thought that if you were going to be taking the round robin off, the whole point was to preserve freshness and to have, you know, the bucket full to empty in a game like last night. That's the whole point. You take off and you treat those round robin games like preseason games to tune up and to be ready to go guns blazing. Again, sorry, bad analogy, but you know what I mean, to go full go there when the games really matter. And so, like, that bugged the crap out of me too. It bums me out that they can so consistently let a bum and a slug like Maroon get under their skin and into their heads. Like, that's the guy that's getting under your skin. You can't figure him out. That's stiff. As an aside, Dan Vladar, you know, 6'6" is great. When you're 6 foot 6 inches tall, it's great. But when you're playing on your stomach, you sort of mitigate the advantage of being 6'6". So that was sort of a scary debut, but really neither here nor there. I don't blame them for getting Halak out of there. You have to preserve him for the next game. So there's a lot of little things there, but the big picture question is this. Is that just another loss? In other words, it doesn't matter whether you lose 7-1 or 2-1. It's a 2-1 series, and you need the next game, and that's just what it is. And we've seen a million series in a lot of different sports where you look like utter ass one night, but it really doesn't matter because it's just one game. Or do you think 7-1 signals capitulation and this thing's over? What do you think, Miz?
I don't think it necessarily signals capitulation. Like, I'm not worried that the Bruins are going to quit if that's what you're asking me. I'm worried whether or not they can really handle this team. That's what I'm worried about. Because that's what it felt like to me last night, that they got bullied. And they got bullied. And again, I'm not talking about the hits. Okay, the Bruins had more hits in the game than Tampa Bay did. But in the, you know, in the post-whistle scrums, I think Tampa's better, bigger, pushing them around a little, and they're more skilled. And so I don't know if the Bruins can handle the Lightning. I'm worried about it.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, the Bruins won a game 7-2 last year against St. Louis, and St. Louis ends up coming back and winning that series. So it's possible, and given the leadership and, you know, the core group here, yeah, I think that they could do it. But I'm with Maz. I just don't think that they're good enough like to compare to the Lightning. The Lightning are doing this without Steven Stamkos. They don't have an answer for someone like Braden Point.
And McDonough.
Yeah, and McDonough, and they're letting that goon Maroon get in their head. Like, last night just made me feel shook. It really did. Like, oh, God, this is a mess.
So I think you nailed it. I think they're going to respond. I just, they've come too far. They have too much on the line. They have too many guys that it should mean a lot to in that room. Not just, you know, the loss last year to St. Louis, what you did in the regular season, but now just committing the last 2 months away from your family for the Fakakta bubble thing, where you're just going to now get all this way, be 2-1 with Tampa and pack it up. No, they're not going to. They're going to empty the bucket. The question, as Maz so succinctly put it, is even when they empty the bucket, is it good enough? If Tampa's playing their game and is at the top of their game, can the Bruins at 1,000%, you know, full steam ahead, beat them? And that's the concern, that they don't have enough to beat Tampa. They'll show up and they'll atone for what happened last night, you know, in terms of effort level and give a crap level. That I'm confident of. But do they have enough to take down the Lightning? And also, I think they're at an organizational crossroads or they're at the precipice. I think this is the last gasp. It's the last gasp of the Zdeno-Chara window, the Chara-Bergeron-Rask window. I mean, Chara might come back for one more, but at what level? Pretty scary the way he's looked. I think he was on the ice for all four power play goals, if I have that right, or all three power play goals last night.
He probably, he deflected one of them in.
I got a helper. The Chara's back or not, you know, him as your guy, that time's just about up, if it's not up already. But the last gasp of the Chara, Rask, Bergeron window. That's it. This is it. They lose on Friday or whenever this game is going to be played. It's over. Series is over. They're not good enough to come back 3-1. That I could say with certainty. They could come back 2-1. They could if they win the next game and make this a series and put some pressure on Tampa and give Tampa the opportunity to choke. You give Tampa the opportunity to choke, they might do it. They might take that opportunity. They've done it in the past. But you got to apply some pressure. So you win this next game, I still think it's a series and you have a shot. You're an underdog, but you have a shot. You lose this next game, it's over. It's over. And the Chara window is done. And so I think there's big stakes here for the Bruins. If there weren't all this other crap going on, this is all we'd be talking about. But we'll talk about it next hour with you and your thoughts. And you can go back to last night as well if you want. That horse show, that gong show of a game. That was a gong show. And you should have known the first period. Ticky-tack, crappy penalty on Nick Ritchie. And then the linesman tackles your defenseman. Like, you should have known right then and there that it wasn't happening. Your thoughts on all of it after Murray's 90-second update. There are no commercials. You can join us at 617-779-0985.
BackstageCountry.com, your online home for all things country music. Like most fans of country music, we're excited to learn that Luke Combs was back in the studio working on his next album. We've come up with our list of iconic Luke Combs music videos. Yes, Lovin' On You made the cut. Text Luke to 45911 to see if your favorite made the list on BackstageCountry.com. Text Luke to 45911 and we'll send the link straight to your phone.